Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the State of the Union.
In their efforts, their enterprise, and their character, the American people are showing that the state of our union is confident and strong.
A blueprint for the nation and for a campaign. We'll hear the politics of the president's speech.
Also, controversy about some voting machines and a company that makes them.
Well, they're one of the largest suppliers of these machines, and were one of the large contributors to the Republican Party in 2000 and 2001, and their CEO, in fact, pledged in August, he said, quote, "I am committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year."
These stories and Atkins Diet fast food coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Polls in New Hampshire show a tight race among Democratic presidential hopefuls heading into next week's first-in-the-nation primary. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Several polls show former Vermont Governor Howard Dean holding on to a narrow lead in New Hampshire, but Iowa winner John Kerry is gaining ground in the state. Dean, who finished third in Iowa, says he needs a win in next Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. Dean met with campaign volunteers in Manchester this morning and urged them to keep up their hard work.
If you really want to take your country back, you've got to come in here and sit at these computers like these guys are doing day after day and call people and spread the message.
Volunteers are calling undecided voters and stuffing envelopes as Dean himself heads home to Vermont for the day. Other Democratic candidates are crisscrossing New Hampshire, delivering speeches and meeting with prospective voters. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Manchester.
President Bush is visiting Toledo, Ohio. He's promoting ideas he raised in last night's State of the Union message. Later today, Mr. Bush will fly on to Arizona, where he'll visit a community college, and he plans to stop in New Mexico tomorrow. All three states are considered key in the presidential race. Mr. Bush won Ohio and Arizona in the 2000 presidential campaign. He lost in New Mexico to Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore by just 400 votes. A new study shows premiums for medical malpractice insurance are 17% lower in states that have capped damage awards. But the study also suggests that a national cap, supported by President Bush, might not solve the nation's malpractice problem. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The study confirms what advocates of malpractice damage award caps have been saying, that a growing number of lawsuits and the growing size of awards are among the primary drivers of spiraling malpractice premiums. But the author, Emory University economist Ken Thorpe, also found that the ups and downs of the insurance cycle, particularly lower investment returns for insurance companies, played a role as well. While the study found that capping damages could slow the growth of malpractice premiums, caps could also have ill effects on the healthcare system as a whole. If awards are rising because more doctors are practicing negligent medicine, then the system is functioning as it was intended, and limiting doctors' liability would take away an incentive to provide higher quality care. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court has narrowly ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency can overrule states in some anti-pollution decisions. The ruling was 5-4. The justices decided the EPA was right to overrule Alaska regulators and order operators of a mine to install more expensive technology to control pollution. Dissenting justices said that decision undercuts states that want to control their own environmental policies. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 10,000, or rather 9, at 10,538. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the government reports that home construction boomed during 2003. The Commerce Department says home construction rose 1.7% in December. That news means that 2003 was one of the best years for home building in a generation. Further, the government says a future gauge of construction looks promising. The agency reports building permit applications were up 3.2% in December. After posting 13 straight quarters of losses, Lucent Technologies reports a second straight profitable quarter while it tries to rebound from the telecommunications slump. Doug Doyle of member station WBGO reports.
The New Jersey-based telecommunications gearmaker says in the first quarter it made a $338 million profit. Lucent Technologies credits its efforts to hold down costs and boost revenues for nearly doubling its gross margin. Lucent's net income was 3 cents per share, compared with a net loss of 11 cents per share in the same period a year ago. That exceeds the 1 cent loss that analysts had expected. Lucent chairwoman and CEO Patricia Russo says they are seeing clear evidence that the market is stabilizing. Chief Financial Officer Frank D'Amelio says the company expects revenues to remain flat or grow modestly compared with last year. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
Jury selection continues in the fraud trial of entrepreneur Martha Stewart. The judge hearing the case has barred reporters from attending question and answer sessions between lawyers and potential jurors. She has ordered that a transcript be released of the first day's questioning. Opening statements are expected to start next week. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of NPR-related books, including the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me quiz book at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The war on terror, Iraq, tax cuts, gay marriage, some of the many topics President Bush touched on in his State of the Union address last night. He spoke broadly of the need to continue the global war on terrorism and laid out a broad domestic agenda. Can the president deliver the programs he wants and still cut the budget deficit, as he also wants to do?
In 2 weeks, I will send you a budget that funds the war, protects the homeland, and meets important domestic needs while limiting the growth in discretionary spending to less than 4%.
Can be paid for is the threat.
This will require that Congress focus on priorities, cut wasteful spending, and be wise with the people's money. By doing so, we can cut the deficit in half over the next 5 years.
We spoke to Brian Riddell of the Heritage Foundation about whether proposals President Bush made in his speech last night can be paid for.
It is realistic if the president proposes specific spending cuts. Unfortunately, last night, the president defended all past spending increases and proposed, by our count, 8 specific calls for new spending hikes. He did not propose any specific spending cuts, however, but we're hoping when he releases his budget, he'll balance out some of these spending increases with cuts.
The budget to come out in about 2 weeks. Now, this is a president who has never cut a spending program, right?
A couple small programs have been reduced, nothing really major. In his first 3 years as president so far, only one spending program has been eliminated, and that was a drug elimination grants for low-income housing. One program eliminated out of a couple thousand programs overall. The overall cost of government has expanded by about 16%, and the discretionary programs, which are the main programs that Congress budgets for every year, will have grown 39% in the first 3 years of the Bush administration. Certainly, this is pleasing to those who favor expansionist government, but those who do not favor expansionist government find those numbers distressing.
And this is way more than even under the Clinton administration, when on average discretionary spending went up 2.5%. In presenting new programs last night, from your perspective as a conservative at the Heritage Foundation, is the president being irresponsible when the money is not there?
I do find the president's budget proposals irresponsible. We're projected to have $500 billion budget deficits for the next decade until the baby boomers retire, Social Security and Medicare costs increase, and the budget deficit gets worse. So unless the president is willing to call to make the tough decisions today and reform spending, even though it can be difficult, we are going to dump a massive tax increase on the next generation. And in doing so, I think the fiscal child abuse that is being inflicted on the next generation is irresponsible.
Brian, at the root, many would say, of budget deficits and ultimately perhaps inability to pay for things that we need to pay for are tax cuts. What's your sense of whether that's a way to go at this, repeal tax cuts. Or in fact, not make them permanent, as the president said he wants to do last night.
You cannot balance a budget with a sluggish economy. Raising taxes would harm the economy and therefore not produce new tax revenues sufficient to balance the budget. A $400 billion budget deficit must be closed with spending cuts as well.
Are there even enough spending cuts out there to close such a gap?
It'll be very difficult to cut spending enough to balance the budget, but there's corporate welfare, again, there's pork, there's waste, fraud, abuse. There are the programs that have less of a constituency than, say, education, health, research, and the programs that are more popular with the public.
Brian Riedel of the Heritage Foundation. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, last night the president also painted a broad vision for no less than all of mankind.
Our nation is strong and steadfast. The cause we serve is right, because it is the cause of all mankind. The momentum of freedom in our world is unmistakable, and it is not carried forward by our power alone.
A blueprint for the nation, but also a clear outline of President Bush's campaign strategy. Boston Globe correspondent Ann Kornblut is on the line from Washington. And Ann, by my watch, the president was 30 seconds into his speech when he said, "We can go forward or turn back," which sounded like the beginning of some campaigning. What struck you about the speech politically?
Well, absolutely. There were political undertones throughout the speech and actually some overtones that were quite explicit, direct shots at the Democrats and some direct counters to the many criticisms that the Democrats have been firing at him from the campaign trail. But like any State of the Union speech, he had to sort of blend some of the politics with a much broader sense that he is still the president, that he's leading the country, and that everything is not being driven exclusively by politics.
Well, by the way, tick off some of the broadsides that you tick off some of the deflections that you mentioned, deflecting criticism.
There were a few big ones. In particular, the prescription drug benefit for Medicare that was passed in Congress recently, that's been a big target on the campaign trail. The No Child Left Behind Act, which Democrats accused Bush of not having funded adequately, even though a lot of them voted for it in the first place. And the Patriot Act those three are really some of the big touchstones on the campaign trail. And the White House has laid pretty low recently. They've let Bush rise above the fray, to mix my metaphors, and stay out of the fight, but they really wanted a chance to respond after so many weeks of hearing this stuff on the campaign trail.
And by the way, the Patriot Act brought an odd moment in the chambers themselves. In the chambers, he was mid-sentence, he said the Patriot Act is going to end next year, and I don't think he expected the huge applause.
Right. There were a few moments in the speech where it sounded a little more like the British Parliament system, where they can yell and scream, and you heard some cheers, and you certainly saw some people sitting very blatantly. So, as usual, there were reactions in the crowd.
And politics all around. Some more messages to the Democrats about Iraq.
Yes. There was certainly the sense here that, as we've known all along, he's going to use Iraq as part of his campaign strategy, no matter who the nominee on the other side is. He made almost fun of some of the Democratic arguments, one of which is that they have not internationalized the effort in Iraq. He ticked off a long list of countries that are participating, and he also said we're not going to get a permission slip to go into Iraq, implying that the Democrats would cede U.S. national interests to other countries. So he really put them on notice that he's going to fight back hard over their accusations on Iraq.
He also said those who oppose the liberation of Iraq, and that will come as a shock to many people who – he also said those who oppose the liberation of Iraq, which categorizes some people in ways I don't think they would see themselves –
Well, and that is certainly how campaigns work. In order to deflect the criticism, he characterizes their views in ways that they wouldn't necessarily characterize them, and they do the same in return.
Briefly, Anne, no mention of Mars.
No mention of Mars. Very little mention of the deficit, and certainly no promise to get rid of it.
Some say that this is in response to criticism from conservatives. I'm thinking of the Wall Street Journal op-ed piece criticizing the huge spending.
Well, that's true. And even some sort of fiscal-minded independents who voted for him in the last election. I think he doesn't want to draw attention to this, especially in a year that he may very well want to talk about privatizing Social Security, which is another big, expensive project.
Mm. Ann, thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Kornblut, staff writer for the Boston Globe in Washington, D.C.
Improving Americans' access to health care was another chord President Bush struck last night. He wants to see individual choice, free market fixes, and less dependence on government.
A government-run health care system is the wrong prescription.
The president revisited old ideas, reviving a push for tax credits for people who buy health insurance. He wants to expand tax-free medical savings accounts. And he did pitch a new concept, at least for him, allowing people to make the cost of health insurance fully tax-deductible. On the line for some analysis of the proposals is Dr. Robert Blendon, professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome, doctor.
Pleasure to be here.
Doctor, 43 million uninsured in this country. That's 15% of the population. Kind of the elephant in the room last night, these uninsured. Anything the president came up with changed their situation?
The president has brought back his tax credit plan, which would provide $3,000 a year to a number of uninsured families towards a family policy which could cost as much as $6,000. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the president's plan would cover about 4 million of the 43 million uninsured. And so it's a small piece. The problem with the tax credits is people have to have the wherewithal to come up with the difference.
Doctor, when health care isn't locked in by government mandate, a government structure to provide health care for people, what's the risk of relying on the market, which is all about somebody making money?
What you often have is that the market can be very responsive to some people, but there are some people often who are very sick who turn out to be not profitable for people in the marketplace, and without government to protect them, sometimes they really don't get the care they need, or they absolutely cannot afford to fill their prescriptions or go back to the physician. So some people get hurt in the market, and others do very, very well if they sort of have the kind of health problems that make it profitable for insurers or pharmaceuticals or many hospitals to care for.
Dr. Robert Blendon is professor of health policy and political analysis at Harvard University. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, about half the State of the Union concerned foreign policy, with the underlying theme, stay the course. Peter Slevin is diplomatic correspondent at The Washington Post. And Peter, the president trumpeted what he sees as successes in Iraq and Afghanistan, but was there any shift in foreign policy that you heard?
No, Robin, his point was not to shift direction, but to say that he's very much on the right course. He couched foreign policy in terms of protecting the United States. This is a president who's looking ahead to the elections in November and trying to show that what he is doing is making Americans safer, and he wants them to feel that way.
I'm going to pull out some lines. He said the most powerful ruler was found in a hole and now sits in a prison cell. For diplomacy to be effective, words must be credible, and no one can now doubt the word of America. That, as they showed a shot of Colin Powell. And the terrorists and their supporters declared war, and war is what they got. Those got a big response.
They did. He was trying to show just how tough his administration is being. He was arguing that by going to war in Iraq and by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, that other rogue leaders around the world are quaking in their boots. He was trying to suggest that by staying this course that America would become safer. Yet you'll also notice that he didn't mention the fact that Osama bin Laden has not been captured, or for that matter, that the FBI director this month said that another attack on the United States is not out of the question.
As far as weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, of course, the 16 words from last year's speech probably resonating for a lot of people. This time around, he said the jury's still out. How much of a landmine topic is that for him?
This still remains to be seen. Clearly, the administration is shifting its rhetoric about Iraq away from the danger that the president himself a year ago said was so very grave, and talking more about liberation and how this was a good deed and overthrowing Saddam Hussein. We'll see whether people hold him to his earlier warnings, or in fact, whether they don't.
Three words notably absent, axis of evil.
Well, I think he may have learned a lesson a year ago or 2 years ago now that phrase wasn't in fact very helpful.
Peter, thank you.
Sure.
Peter Slevin, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Just ahead, controversy over voting machines.
And later in the show, Atkins-friendly fast food.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Primary season is in full swing, and voters around the country will be asked over the next several months to choose the Democratic challenger to President Bush, all leading up to the general election in November, one day that determines the course of the nation. Remember the last presidential election? It dragged on for a lot more than one day. Hanging chads and recounts caused many voters to wonder whether their votes were actually being counted at all. This year, election organizers are hoping to avoid all that. One idea, electronic voting machines. But how reliable are these contraptions? Could we be headed for the electronic, high-tech equivalent of hanging chads? Some people think the answer is at least maybe, and our regular information technology commentator is here to tell us more. David Weinberger, welcome.
Hi.
David, electronic voting. First off, what is it? How does it work?
When you go into the booth, you see a touchscreen, electronic computer
touchscreen.
Yep. Has the names of the candidates or the ballot initiatives, and you touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you vote.
Simple as that. Why are we seeing these systems now more than ever before? Is it a Palm Beach year 2000 phenomenon, or were they on their way anyway?
But did something happen in Palm Beach in 2000?
Yeah, there was this little discrepancy about one of the presidential elections.
Yeah, that might explain it then, because Congress passed the Help America Vote Act in October of 2002, which requires states to upgrade their voting systems. It provides $4 billion in funds in order to get rid of punch cards, and while they're at it, get rid of the lever-based systems also.
Now, was the technology rushed in any way? Is that why some are concerned about its reliability? Why are some concerned about its reliability?
Well, because they're computers, and they're black boxes, so nobody knows what's going on inside of them. And so you have all the sorts of worries that you can possibly have about computers, that the software is buggy, perhaps. We don't know because we can't see inside the box.
Yeah.
The companies won't let their code be made public because they say it's proprietary and it needs to be kept secure. But the consequence of that is that computer experts can't look at it to see if it's buggy. So it may be buggy. There's always a possibility or suspicion that when something is unauditable, that there's some type of hanky-panky going on as well.
Hacking.
And not to mention hacking. In fact, at the beginning of this year, one of the companies, Vote Here, told the world that, in fact, hackers had broken into their system and looked around and maybe taken some code out with them.
Well, the mind reels right away, and you can picture movies and screenplays already being written about it. Are you telling me that there could be a presidential election in November 2004 that conceivably could be hacked into and changed, modified in some way?
Well, there's that fear, of course, but there's also the fear that people will be afraid of that, that we'll get results that, let's say, don't match exit polls. And people will now wonder. And it's that wonder, whether it's justified or not, that you really want to get rid of in a democracy. You don't want anybody questioning the validity of the polls.
Now, another controversy out there involves Diebold Corporation. Tell us about that.
Well, they're one of the largest suppliers of these machines, and they've stepped into some controversy in part by how they responded to some criticism. It didn't help that they've been quite forthright in their own political leanings. They were one of the large contributors to the Republican Party in 2000 and 2001, and their CEO, in fact, pledged in August in an invitation to a Republican fundraiser. He said, quote, "I am committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year."
Which yeah.
It's a free country. He's a citizen. He can do that.
But they do make voting machines.
But they also make voting machines.
And then there's a question of these internal memos, right?
Yes, they got hacked. Some internal memos from a message board were stolen and then published on the internet.
And memos that said?
For example, quote, "This company is a mess. We should stop development on all new and old products and concentrate on making them stable instead of showing vaporware." Or, so this is a message from one Diebold employee to the Diebold community, "Our department is being audited by the county. I have been waiting for someone to give me an explanation as to why Precinct 216 gave Al Gore a minus 16,022 when it was uploaded." This is not the sort of memo that you really want floating around.
And float around it did. Diebold was furious about it, and it's still afloat.
Yes, the set of memos have been moved from server to server on the internet so that they're always available, as Diebold sent out threatening letters, legal threatening letters, to get them shut down, which they've stopped doing now, by the way.
And Dennis Kucinich, he made sure that the memos stayed afloat.
Yes, he posted a link to them on his congressional website.
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich, of course, congressman from Ohio and presidential candidate. Well, where does this leave us, David? Should the average voter feel like their vote is secure, whether it's in a primary on an electronic voting machine or in the big Megillah next November?
Well, there's been a flurry of activity. Some voting areas have refused now to install these types of machines, and there's a congressional proposal from Congressman Rush Holt, the Voter Confidence and Increased Accessibility Act, that would require electronic voting machines also to print a paper copy. So you would press the touch screen, you would get a paper copy that has the right marking on it, and it would get deposited into a secure place so that there's at least a way of doing a recount, a way of counting the votes manually.
Paper? A recount? I thought we were talking about electronic voting machines.
Absolutely. But the problem with electronic voting machines ultimately is that if somebody has a question about them, valid or not, all you can do at this point is run the same software again, which is like buying a second copy of the newspaper to check if the first one was true.
Well, we certainly don't want to imply that all voting machines are problematic. It's probably far from the case, but it would just take one, wouldn't it?
That's the problem.
David Weinberger is Here and Now's regular information technology commentator. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. David, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
You can send us mail the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a day in the life of a health clinic in New Hampshire.
The sister band, the Neilds. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we'll check in on the Democrats in New Hampshire, including a look at labor's role post-Dick Gephardt.
What people who are rank-and-file union members and rank-and-file Democrats share in common is a desire to beat George Bush.
Also, the food industry is leaping on the Atkins diet bandwagon, which puzzles most nutritionists.
I have combed Atkins' book, trying to figure out really what they were recommending and really how that measured up nutritionally. And I had an impossible time.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush, on the heels of last night's State of the Union address, took his 2004 election campaign to Toledo, Ohio this morning, the first stop of a two-day swing that will highlight his job training and counterterrorism proposals. The president says the U.S. economy is strong, but there are still troubled times in some parts of the country.
The march to war affected our psychology and confidence. It is hard to be optimistic about the future when you turn on your TV screens and say America is marching to war. War is not positive. War sends the signal that there will be uncertainty. We're now marching to peace.
Democrats like presidential candidate John Kerry campaigning in New Hampshire today said the president has already failed to deliver on job creation promises. The state of Ohio moves another step closer to passing a law that bans same-sex marriage. A Senate committee approved the measure this morning, and it could go before the full Senate this afternoon. A similar version passed in the House last month. The bill, considered one of the most far-reaching in the nation, puts into law that same-sex marriages would be against the strong public policy of the state. If signed into law, Ohio may be only the second state, besides Nebraska, that would prohibit benefits for unmarried partners of state employees. Another roadside bomb targeting U.S. forces in Iraq. A bomb went off on a roadside near the northern city of Mosul today as a convoy of American vehicles was passing. Three U.S. soldiers were wounded, as were seven other people. A class action lawsuit has been filed against Northwest Airlines, charging that the airline shared passenger data with the government in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Northwest reportedly gave passenger records from October to December of 2001 to the federal government for a study on passenger screening. The suit, filed in federal court in Minnesota, contends the airline violated its own policy as well as federal and state laws. Residential construction picked up in December, making 2003 the best year for home builders in a quarter century. The Commerce Department reports that housing construction increased by 1.7% last month over November's numbers. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 8 points at 10,537. The Nasdaq is down. The S&P is down as well.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A little less than 20% of the American electorate belong to unions. Now, in what many expect to be a fiercely competitive general election and what's already a knockdown, drag-out, and wildly unpredictable Democratic nominations sweepstakes, that near 20% should really matter, right? But how much does it? Well, to discuss this question, and yes, I admit, to do just a bit of political handicapping in New Hampshire as the clock ticks down there toward Tuesday's primary, we're joined now by Curtis Ganz, director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate in Washington, D.C. Hi, Curtis.
Hi.
And also on the line from Manchester, New Hampshire, is Peter Canellos, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Curtis, starting with you, does a union's endorsement matter anymore? Both Gebhardt and Howard Dean won endorsements from major unions in Iowa. And we know what happened to Howard Dean, and Mr. Gebhardt is dropping out of the race and plans, in fact, to get out of politics. Union endorsement matter?
Well, it matters a lot in general elections because about two-thirds of the union membership in a general election will tend to support Democrats. You know, that figure was a little lower when Ronald Reagan was president.
Why was it such a non-factor this time? In the past, it helped specifically Richard Gephardt in Iowa. He won as a result of union endorsements. What happened this time?
What people who are rank-and-file union members and rank-and-file Democrats share in common is a desire to beat George Bush. The critical question in the primary for those people was not, you know, Gephardt's, you know, longstanding loyalty to the unions and his trade issue, but picking the person who could most beat George Bush.
And that just trumped everything, despite the fact that 2 million manufacturing jobs or more have been lost during the Bush years. Peter Kanellis, you write in today's Boston Globe about Manchester, New Hampshire, a manufacturing town where there isn't a lot of manufacturing for a long time now. How does that cut in New Hampshire?
Well, New Hampshire is in better shape economically right now than Iowa is. And I think that economic issues will play a little bit less well or less strongly for the candidates here than they did in Iowa.
Yeah, in fact, you write, the loss of manufacturing jobs feels like an element of the cycle of life, like old people dying and babies being born, as if people are kind of moving on from this question of manufacturing jobs and maybe moving on from union clout as well. Peter, your
thoughts?
Yes,
I think that that's what's happened certainly in southern New Hampshire. There are places in New Hampshire like Berlin, which is far to the north, which are traditional mill towns, and that's the area where most of the jobs have been lost recently.
Does the issue, Curtis Gans, of free trade, which Richard Gephardt pushed hardest on, even to the point of calling for the repeal of NAFTA, does that issue cut with voters, or are voters perfectly happy with the subsidies that do protect American jobs? And if American jobs go overseas because there aren't subsidies and there isn't enough protection, they can live with that too. 2 million manufacturing jobs lost. Is this a major issue this time around or not?
It is a major issue this time around, but it is a major general election issue.
Mm-hmm.
All the candidates at least pay lip service to the question of outsourcing and the decline in jobs.
The problem is that with the jobs are being lost in very specific areas and very specific manufacturing areas. And that's only a small slice, actually, of the union movement. So you can talk about how 20% of the electorate is in unions. It's a vastly smaller percentage who are in the industries that are in danger of losing significant manufacturing jobs. So it's probably a smaller cut of the electorate than people think, and may have less impact than people think.
Peter, turning to the political landscape where you are in New Hampshire, one development there, the important Manchester Union Leader newspaper endorsed Joseph Lieberman. When the Des Moines Register endorsed John Edwards, that had a big impact on Edwards' success in Iowa. What do you think that will mean for Joseph Lieberman in New Hampshire?
Well, I think it does give Lieberman a boost. I don't think that the Manchester Union Leader is in the same commanding position that the Des Moines Register is. The Des Moines Register is really the dominant paper in the entire state of Iowa. Hmm. The Union Leader is probably dominant in terms of circulation, but is also known for its eccentricity. This is a paper that endorsed Phil Crane over Ronald Reagan in 1980, for example. So they frequently make quirky choices and then push them really, really hard in their news pages as well as on their editorial page. So I think it feels a little bit less of a zeitgeist reading than the Des Moines Register endorsement was.
Curtis Gans, the latest Zogby poll shows Dean with 25%, Kerry with 23%. That's a statistical tie. Clark with 16%. Edwards is at 7. Now, I want to ask you about Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts and Wesley Clark. Now, they would seem to appeal to a similar voter, both with the foreign policy experience that they bring to the table. If one or the other weren't there, do you think that the votes of the one or the other would go to the other and that would be devastating for Dean, if you follow me?
I think some of the, you know, Clark votes, if he weren't there, would go to Kerry, but you don't know where they'd go. I mean, you know, Clark and Dean were the only two original outspoken opponents of the war, so some of Clark's support would go to Dean, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's true of Kerry. You know, some of the pragmatists, you know, would go to Clark, and the people who see him as a more effective long-term anti-war multilateralist spokesperson might go to Dean. What that poll essentially tells me a little bit about is that this race may not be settled early.
Yeah.
New Hampshire may not be, you know, as decisive or as narrowing as it hasn't been in previous years. sometimes it's been decisive and sometimes it's, you know, narrowed the field down to two candidates. I'm not sure that, that's going to happen this time. And if that doesn't happen this time, you're going to probably look to the first week in March before you might even see it winnowed down to two people and a decisive winner.
I did want to add to what Curtis was saying. I agree with two of the things that he pointed out. One is, I think that Clark takes away from Dean as much as he takes away from Kerry, because there's a large number of sort of maverick voters here in New Hampshire who are very against the system and tend to vote for outsiders. And both Dean and Clark have tapped into that kind of feeling much mm-hmm. more than Kerry has. Mm-hmm. And I also think that it's possible that the race could go on for a while. New Hampshire will be somewhat decisive, I think, if Kerry wins, and put him in a good position to win the nomination.
Peter, you mentioned maverick voters, another wild card, 16% in that Zogby poll, undecided.
Yes, it's hard to know whether the undecided voters are the mavericks or whether the undecided voters are more traditional voters who are really sizing up the establishment candidates. But I think that there will be a late break one way or the other towards Clark or Kerry or Dean. And I think John Edwards is only hoping to sort of, you know, have an impressive finish, whether it's third place, whether it's 20%, who knows. But anything that's perceived as a show of strength in New Hampshire is a plus for John Edwards, because he's a Southern candidate and expectations are fairly low here.
Anybody who thinks he can predict what will happen next Tuesday is crazy.
We shouldn't be handicapping it at all, but it's kind of fun. I want to thank both of you. Peter Canellos, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And Curtis Ganz, director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. Thanks, Curtis.
Thank you, sir.
Still to come, many fast food restaurants are featuring Atkins diet dishes. We'll look at what's on the menu.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Sims Online is an online role-playing game. From your computer, you move around a little virtual town called Alphaville and meet other real people who've created characters that play chess, keep house, and, according to one player, engage in sex talk, mob behavior, and prostitution. And some of these players, he says, are in real life young children. Peter Ludlow has been chronicling events in the Sims game in his own online newspaper, the Alphaville Herald. His Sims character was banned from the game after the Sims parent company said he broke a rule by advertising his newspaper in the game. Well, Peter Ludlow is a professor of linguistics and philosophy at the University of Michigan. He joins us. And, Professor, you say you went to Sims Online for research?
Well, I was mostly interested in just watching the social structures that were created there.
And that's why you went on?
Yeah, that's why I went on, and I was interested in the economy, and I was interested in how groups formed and so forth. And along the way, I was reporting certain kinds of events that I guess the company considered to be unsavory. You know, there are cases like lots of cyber brothels where people engage in cyber sex, and you would find children running these or working in them.
Let me ask you, Professor, how do you know that they're children, because it's all in cyberspace? Can't people lie about their ages?
Sure, of course they can. I just happen to know one of the characters that was running one of the cyber brothels.
So you're obviously concerned about it. Do you think that's why the company banned you?
That's what most people think, and I have no other... There's no other explanation for why they banned me.
But if you join to see how societies form...
Right.
Isn't this actually how societies form? I mean, this is what people do in societies.
Yes. I mean, there are a couple of elements. I mean, there is an element of what they call griefers, troublemakers, and so forth in the game. And lots of times these people are viruses which lead to the formation of social groups. So the reason I was interested in some of these quote-unquote unsavory characters, which represent a minority of The Sims Online, is how groups would form to protect themselves against these kinds of individuals.
And by the way, the company that owns Sims Online, Electronic Arts, has said that they would investigate any reports of young people having virtual sex online. But they also point out that, you know, it is cyberspace. For instance, the brothel that you speak of, it's not really happening. It's role-playing.
Right. There are children role-playing with adults, and they're engaging in sex chat with adults and playing prostitutes.
What do you think should happen now? I mean, there are those who say there should be no regulation with what happens in cyberspace. That's the appeal of it.
Yeah, I think it's fine to... I don't have a problem with what happens in the game. I think someone has to be honest about the content of the game and what's happening in the game, because parents and policymakers need to know what their children are being exposed to. But I'm not advocating that anyone censor it or shut it down or anything like that. I'm just saying be honest about the content of the game. Let parents know what's happening in there.
Hmm. Professor, before we let you go, you know, there are people who are hearing this for the first time and thinking, what the heck? You know, what are people doing there anyway? Sort of, you know, get a life, not a virtual life. What have you found to be the appeal of it?
Well, it's not really a game so much as it's a kind of platform where people can get together and socialize. But
you can go down to your town hall and do that, or to your library.
Well, no, but that's not exactly right, because common spaces are disappearing, and these virtual communities are among the last of the common spaces, along with shopping malls, where, for example, kids can get together and talk and exchange ideas.
Professor, thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Professor Peter Ludlow, he spoke to us from the University of Michigan.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Move over low fat, make way for low carb. Low or no carb peanut butter, spaghetti sauce, tortilla chips are coming to a supermarket near you. And fast food restaurants are scrambling to wrap their hamburgers with lettuce leaves and rebake their bread rolls. It's all in response to the popularity of the low-carb, high-protein Atkins diet, which has been around for 20 years but has become the diet du jour for millions of Americans who've interpreted it to mean that they can eat all the red meat and high fat they want and shed pounds. Is that a good thing? Joining us in the studio is Jean Goldberg. She's professor of nutrition at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Well, you know, nutritionists have been screaming about the dangers of Atkins for years. Are you one of them?
Yes, I'm guilty of that. And it's not 20 years, by the way. It's 30 years in its modern incarnation that Atkins has been coming back over and over.
What, first of all, is your concern about the diet?
The diet is very high in saturated fat, as commonly eaten. You can have an Atkins diet that is very high in protein and very low in fat, but it's not the diet that's palatable, and it's not the diet that people are eating.
Right.
So it's, even as the Atkins folks describe it currently, the saturated fat, that's the one that really clogs up the arteries, that they are recommending is twice what the current government guidelines for saturated fat are.
And remind us, what's saturated fat in as opposed to unsaturated fat?
Saturated fat is the fat that's found mostly in animal products like beef, and it's dairy fat.
And unsaturated is vegetables,
vegetable
fish.
Oil,
yeah.
And fish.
Right. Okay, well, even the Atkins people, according to New York Times food reporter Marion Burroughs, those who promote this diet, the Atkins people themselves, are now encouraging people to limit their intake of red meat and those saturated fats you mentioned to only 20% of their daily intake. As you said, that's still higher than someone like you would want, but it's a lot less than people think. I've met people who say you can eat steak for lunch, you can go to McDonald's, it's okay as long as you don't eat a potato.
Right. In fact, when you mentioned the potato, one of the other things that's wrong with the Atkins diet is that he really eschews most vegetables. And certainly fruits are the bad guys. Any diet that cuts out fruits and vegetables is really open to suspicion.
Yeah, but what do you say, Jean, to people who have lost 40, 50, 60 pounds?
I say see me in 6 months, see me in a year, and see where you are.
What are you concerned about, that they may have gained the weight back? Or, as we're hearing from so many doctors, that they'll now have heart disease. They might be thin, but they'll have heart disease.
I think some people are at greater risk than others. I mean, people who already have demonstrated cardiovascular disease should not go on this diet with an emphasis on steak and eggs. If they want to do the diet, the emphasis should be on things like very low-fat cheeses and fat-free milk. What I was talking about, though, is the fact that people regain the weight that they've lost. One of the I read Marion's column, and one of the things that she points out is that Atkins is blaming the media, saying, "We always said to limit the amount you eat." Well, I've got to tell you, I have combed Atkins' book in 2, 3, 4 years ago, trying to figure out really what they were recommending and really how that measured up nutritionally. And I had an impossible time of understanding what they actually meant by a portion. Now they're saying it's the media who said all you want. Well, I got to tell you, I think if they were concerned about the media giving the wrong message, this is a little late for them to be coming forth and saying, no, we didn't mean you could eat all you want. Mm. That is, in fact, exactly what was pushed for decades.
Well, and it's the bandwagon that the food industry is jumping on. You've been shopping. You've brought in some products. Here's a loaf of bread that's called Carb Counting. It's got an Atkins thing right on it. It's Arnold bread, but it's got an Atkins signature on it that says it's got 6 grams of carbs. Here's Carb Countdown Milk, 75% less carbs, it says. What does that mean?
The ones I chose because one is simply a loaf of whole grain bread. Whole grain bread is a fine food. And it tells you, if you read it very carefully, that 3 of the grams of carbohydrate probably don't count toward calories because they're fiber. It doesn't really tell you, but that is why it is. 3 grams of carbohydrate is 12 calories. 12 calories is an error that you could make in cutting a slice of bread if you were cutting it yourself. I mean, it's infinitesimal.
And as it says on the back of this package, this product is not appropriate for the first 2 weeks of the induction phase of the Atkins nutritional approach. So obviously, within the diet, there's all sorts of restrictions. But for instance, on the milk, what is a low-carb milk?
Well, it's interesting. I just found this over the weekend, actually in Ohio, and I looked at it and I thought, how do they make low-carb milk? Well, the fact is they don't make low-carb milk. What they've done, it can't legitimately fit the description of something called milk, because if you look at the ingredients list, which incidentally, if there is one place consumers should learn to look, it's the ingredients list. That really tells the story. The first ingredient in this is water. The second is ultra-filtered fat-free milk, whatever that means. The third ingredient is cream. And then I thought, well, how do they get the calcium up to be equal to milk? Because it really is. And they add calcium caseinate and they add whey protein concentrate, which are very inexpensive ingredients. And they do get the calcium up to be equivalent to that in milk. Exactly how this stacks up against milk, the equivalent amount of 1% fat milk, which is calorically equivalent to, I don't know. And the other question I'd raise about this one is, which by the way has artificial sweeteners in it, I would question how well the calcium is absorbed from this. I don't know that it's less well absorbed, but I don't know that it is as well absorbed. So it's called dairy beverage. It has less carbohydrate, but its calories are exactly the same as if you drink a cup of 1% fat milk.
But again, we mentioned the fast food restaurants. TGI Fridays is starting an Atkins-approved diet. It includes Tuscan spinach dip, sizzling chicken with broccoli. There's Anheuser-Busch has a low-carb beer. Isn't it better for people if they're going to eat at fast food restaurants and they're going to drink beer, that they do drink low carb?
If they're going to drink beer and they get as much enjoyment out of drinking low-carb beer as long as they check the label and make sure that the carbohydrates that have been removed haven't been replaced with something else. You've got to add, you've got to put in things that provide mouthfeel. You've got to provide the qualities that one expects from drinking a glass of beer.
Or else you're going to drink 10 glasses of beer because you're trying
to
get
possibly
that.
Because the beer that you're drinking is disappointing you. Sip a little more slowly and have the beer you like.
You know, the business pages of many papers are doing stories on this, and they're talking about the danger of food chains linking themselves to a diet because diets are seen as fads. But some would say this one's been around, as you point out, over 30 years.
I really do think this is too much of a craze, that it's really soaring. I've never seen anything soar with the speed that this one is. It's also become the focus of great interest within industry, and everybody's racing to put out carbohydrate-controlled foods. The proof ultimately will be in the eating.
And that brings me to another point. People are labeling all their new products with carb-free, carb countdown, all this stuff. There's no FDA regulation of any of this.
No, unfortunately, there is no regulation of this or of a lot of some of the other claims. The other thing is, even those that are regulated, it's awfully hard for consumers to understand what the labeling really means, what the front of the package information really means. It's awfully misleading. And the problem, in my view, being fresh out of the supermarket, is it's gotten exponentially worse for consumers to understand what all these front of package claims mean.
Jean Goldberg, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Jean Goldberg is professor of nutrition at the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy at Tufts University. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette and Boris Trapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
We'll see a day in the life of a health clinic in New Hampshire.
And we speak to a filmmaker who followed Arms Inspector David Kaye around in Iraq.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.